You're listening to On the Point, the News Collective show formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Grace Jenkins.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
And I'm Joshua Azizi. It's Friday, October 16th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC Vancouver's campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkamatum-speaking Musqueam people.
Today, we'll be hearing from drug policy advisor Karen Ward about the proposed overdose prevention site in Yaletown, plus audio from this week's council meeting about it.
We'll also talk about the provincial election and sexism towards NDP candidate Bowen Ma. We'll play some comments by Green candidate Stephanie Hendy, as well as talk about the leaders' debate earlier this week.
But first, let's talk about municipal politics, specifically the proposed overdose prevention site on Seymour Street.
We talked a bit about this last week. If you missed it, there's a motion in Vancouver City Council right now to allow the first overdose prevention site outside the downtown east side in Yaletown, just off of Granville Street.
Yaletown has had a temporary OPS for a few months as fatal overdoses continue to spike throughout the province. Vancouver Coastal Health and Rain City Housing want to create a permanent space on the corner of Seymour and Helmickin to help drug users in the area. Rain City already runs the overdose prevention at St. Paul's Hospital and wants to modify the lease on 115 Seymour Street to create an indoor space, and that's what the motion in council is about.
The motion has had a lot of pushback from citizens. Council had 115 speakers signed up to speak on Tuesday. They didn't get through all of them, but discussion got very heated. Before the council got to hear from citizens, though, they got to question all the stakeholders involved. Co-op councillor Jean Swanson asked Isaac Holmgren, one of the managers at Rain City Housing, about the site and about the backlash. Let's listen to what she had to say.
Has there been any sort of community uproar about the St. Paul's site? When people assume that drug users as a group are criminals or a danger to kids or that they shouldn't be using the same parks as other people, what is the health impact on people who do use drugs?
I could speak to both of those. So the first question around concerns about the St. Paul site, there have been some concerns and complaints from community. We've been engaged with BCH and St. Paul's Hospital around a number of kind of responses, including the addition of security, addition of staff to sort of be able to usher people into the site in a safer way. I will say that a lot of the concerns that have come up have been around visibility of people waiting outside the site to access services, and those have all happened after sort of what's being called the lockdown at St. Paul's Hospital. So historically, service users were able to spend time in the hospital, use the washrooms there. There were a number of other places in the community where people could congregate. And as Chris mentioned, a lot of the public health orders and sort of direction around COVID has discouraged or completely precluded the possibility of people being able to congregate anywhere other than directly outside a service like this. There has also, unfortunately, been some pretty violent and unacceptable sort of responses from neighbors, including people in buildings adjacent to the site throwing eggs on service users waiting to operate.
Oh my God.
So, I mean, for sure some response, but we've been, as an operator, Rain City takes this stuff really seriously, and we know kind of however misguided the responses can be, it's really important to make sure that we're building bridges with all of our neighbors, right? And then, to address the second point, I think historically there is a dynamic where when sort of the safety of youth is incurred in conversations around services like this that carry a lot of stigma, it can create a lack of safety for service users. But more importantly, I think we need to mention the fact that youth are service users, right? And the same people who may be accessing a service like Covenant House and working on a recovery plan and doing their best to sort of, get on a new path, as people have mentioned, may also have moments where they need to access an overdose prevention service. And if those services are not accessible to them, the outcome for them is going to be the same as it would be for anyone else who suffers a fatal overdose, right? Regardless of their intentions or the other really great services that are being provided to them. And we've seen that dynamic over and over again in so many of the harm reduction services we offer.
So in the stigma that goes along with these generalizations and stereotypes, what impact does that have on people's ability to get the help they need?
Hi, it's Guy Felicella, peer clinical advisor for VCH. The stigma and discrimination that impacts substance users, and even in my own life, was just as powerful as the substances themselves. I'd used in the Granville, Yaletown area, Robson area for decades. And without those services and also the backlash, the trauma that's impacted from our society towards drug users really isolates you further. And the reason why people are dying alone is really the driving force. It's not just the drugs, but it's also the stigma and discrimination that exists in our society. And if in fact that facility was located, or if a facility existed in that area when I was using substances, I would have definitely taken advantage of using it there just the same way as I took advantage of using Insight when it was implemented in the downtown east side.
So the stigma increases the risk of dying alone. Thank you.
That was Guy Felicella, peer clinical advisor for Vancouver Coastal Health, at the end talking about the stigma and backlash against drug users.
So I wanted to just open it up and talk about this idea of the stigma that's been going around against drug users in the city sort of since the pandemic started. I don't think it's ever been this bad, at least this concerted, in a while. I don't know whether that's everyone else's experience. Like, what do you think about the sort of backlash that's been happening right now against drug users in Vancouver especially?
I found it very striking in a lot of the quotes from people who are against the measures going forward, talking about our or their city, and it just really stuck out to me how they don't consider people who are addicted to drugs as part of their community.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Like, I agree, stigma around like drug use has been like really, really bad already, but it does seem to have like increased over the pandemic. And especially we're looking at the increase in overdose deaths that are like technically preventable, but an all-time high right now. So
yeah, it's almost I don't want to say it's strange that it's increased now, because it makes sense that tensions have gotten so bad lately because of the pandemic kind of making everything worse and all. But I mean, I've lived in, well, not Vancouver itself, because I'm on the North Shore, but like I've, lived around the Vancouver area for all my life. And I've never seen kind of this much backlash to just public drug use. And it's just kind of shocking. And part of me is kind of wondering, like, maybe people think this all the time, but they don't say it. And now they think it's okay to be this stigmatizing. Maybe this is just like kind of boiled under the surface and now people are acting like it's okay. I don't know.
I think it's possible that people are just like bored and frustrated and they're like lashing out, which is not an excuse in any way. But like we are, during the pandemic, we've seen an increase in hate crimes and stuff like that, not just specifically to drug users, but also like to Asian people. And so like we're seeing that increased. And it's a very difficult time, and a lot of people, have lost their jobs and they have nothing better to do. So it's like, I mean, maybe people are bored. This is just like a hypothesis. Like, I don't know if this is true.
A factor could be that people are noticing it more now because there are fewer like public restrooms open, because and a lot of places are closed because of the pandemic. And it could also be that they just don't have anywhere else to go.
Yeah, no, like, I mean, this is something that Karen Ward talked about in the interview a lot, like public places where people who use drugs usually would go a lot, like SROs kind of using indoors, like those are, you're not allowed guests in there anymore. So definitely places like that are shut down more these days. And so where do people go? They go out onto the streets.
And a huge part of it also is sort of the online movement almost to sort of demonize drug users. that we saw with this group called Safer Vancouver, which was affiliated with homeowners in, you know, Shaughnessy, the richest part of this town. There was a Thai story about this very recently, where there was a Facebook group called, I think, Concerned Citizens or something, where they were basically singling out homeless people and drug users for saying, and one of the directors, Dallas Brody, who also spoke at the council meeting, he said that they should all be shipped into like Navy ships and like sent there, which is just too dehumanizing. So like there's also that huge aspect, which is something that we'll hear about, the astroturfing of concerned citizens sort of role playing as concerned citizens, really. Some people don't even live in Yale Town who spoke at the meeting, and they talked about, you know, their neighborhood versus the drug users. So that's a huge part of it also. And something that I find really interesting is that they bring up the sort of crime and public safety aspect to this. That's a huge, like, oh, you know, we've never felt this unsafe in our entire lives, whatever. But crime statistics for the entire city has actually gone down compared to last year, like significantly down compared to last year, especially in Yale Town also. Some people say, oh, we don't just report the crimes anymore. And VPD is saying that, oh, we don't prosecute as much, whatever. The fact remains that reports of crime have significantly gone down. So that really lends credence to the theory that this is an astroturfing operation. Although, I mean, I can't deny that. I mean, probably some people are legitimately concerned also, but that aspect sticks out to me a lot, especially.
But I remember listening to her speak at City Council. It was ugly.
Pretty nasty.
It was just, I felt a little gross after listening to it.
Very nasty, yeah.
The attacks on drug users were certainly very visible in council on Tuesday. Garth Mullins, who creates the Crackdown podcast, spoke about the effects this has on drug users and the historical context of the Yale Town area.
Thanks. My name's Garth Mullins. I'm a member of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. I also make the Crackdown podcast about the overdose crisis. And obviously, I'm speaking in favor of the motion. I just, I think about that part of the city, you know, and I remember when I was a teenager buying and injecting cocaine about 100 feet away from where the proposed site is. And I wasn't the only one. There were a lot of younger people around there and around Granville Street. This is when Granville Street was entertained. Wasn't remodeled. This was the old, like, seedier version, you know, full of porn shops and the old Capital Six and all that. And so when people say, oh, this family-friendly neighborhood is changed, well, I've actually seen it change from before. So the more gentrified aspect of the neighborhood, that's new. People who use drugs were here before. And so either we make services available for people, or you're suggesting displacement. So this idea of people who use drugs coming into the neighborhood, it's not really true. It's more like developers came in. We were already there. You know, I want to also remember one other time when I was a lot younger. I've been around long enough to obviously remember the Capital Six, but also to remember the previous overdose crisis in the city. There was a publicly declared public health emergency for strong heroin and lots of overdoses here in Vancouver in the 90s. And I was a heroin user all the way through that. I'm on methadone now, but I used heroin and opioids for most of my adult life. And during that time, there was no safe injection sites. And I was scared, but I also couldn't stop. You know, this is the nature of getting wired to opioids, is you can't just decide to change like that. Not most people anyway. So I was scared. And so when I used, sometimes in my apartment, sometimes in a McDonald's bathroom, sometimes wherever I could find a little place, I would, you know, you tie off, you put the needle in your arm, you get the vein, you flag to make sure you're in it, you slam it home, like you inject the drugs, And then I would put that stuff away carefully, like my take my needle and everything, and I would get outside as fast as I could so that if I fell down, if I had an overdose, my hope was that someone on the street would find me and call the ambulance. And if not, then someone would find my body. And the people who are opposed to this proposal today, they want us to go back there. They want us to go back to when I was a kid and I had to walk out on the street and hopefully someone would find my overdose body. And we can't go back. This crisis is so much worse. And the people who are coming before council today, I think a lot of them are, you know, legitimately concerned citizens, and there needs to be some engagement, but there's also political organizing going on behind the scenes. There is a group of people who have sought to organize themselves to drive people who don't have housing, to drive poor people, to drive drug users out of their neighborhoods, and to use videotaping of us when we're in public, posted online to try and shame us away. And they don't come to you today in council and say their true feelings, their true proposals. Because if they would, they would say a popular one from one of the groups is talking about drug users, quote, they would have been better to bring in a naval ship to set up a barrack somewhere and take them, that is drug users, us, away from the city so that they have to stay there. This is a group that's come before you in council. This is a group that has had support of people, of counselors. This is a group that has connections to one of the political parties' boards of directors. So this is the kind of people who are leading and organizing the opposition to this site. I'm not saying everybody is opposed for these reasons, but the people who are politically organizing. So I encourage people who've spoken out against the motion today and people who are thinking about voting against it, look at who's on your side. Look at who's beside you. And if that strikes you as odious, consider your view.
All right, we're going to take a short break, listen to some ads, and then we'll get back to you in a few minutes.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam speaking Musqueam people.
Are you energetic, mature, and committed to making a difference in the life of an Indigenous youth? Then you'd make a great mentor. Volunteer mentors at Vancouver's Urban Native Youth Association help youth recognize their many strengths and words towards future goals. To learn more about how you can become a mentor to a deserving young person, please visit unya.bc.ca/mentorship.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theatre, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theatre, visit their website at www.riotheatre.ca.
Welcome back to On the Point, the News Collective show on CITR 101.9 FM. That was Garth Mullins from the Crackdown podcast talking about the history of the Granville Street and why overdose prevention is required outside of the downtown east side. You can listen to Crackdown each Friday right here on CITR for more about BC's overdose crisis.
Karen Ward also spoke at the council meeting on Tuesday. She's a drug policy advisor with the City of Vancouver and an activist in support of harm reduction policies. She encouraged council to approve the site. I caught up with Ward a day after she spoke at council to learn more about why she supports the Yaletown OPS site and how she would respond to some of the concerns about public safety in the area that people fear could pop up as a result of it. And it was a really fascinating interview, and she had a ton to say about the subject. It was just very good.
Should we give it a listen?
Let's play it now.
So I guess kind of to start, can you tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Oh, dear. My name's Karen Ward. Currently, I am on, I'm on a contract with the city advising on drug policy and poverty reduction. And that has been since the before time, since 2019. And currently, I'm also doing some communication outreach and COVID information sharing around the downtown east side. I've lived down here for over 10 years and worked in a whole bunch of different have been a part of different organizations, including Gallery Gache and been contributing in there with the drug users. And I guess that's probably pretty easy. I also do some housing activism. I'm not activism, but I do some housing advocacy for low-income and homeless people, having been unhoused myself and, having been poor, continuing to be relatively poor.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I had read in the TIE that you had, done work on the report for the proposed Yale Town overdose prevention site.
I've been pushing. We have all been pushing for a site downtown for, mm-hmm. Years and since 2017. I'm one of the people who are on the community action team for Vancouver. There's a whole bunch of people with lived experience, and that was the third thing on our must have, really, really need list was some services for people outside of the downtown side. It's a huge deal and a big issue that we don't have anything. Anything for people who don't live in the neighborhood. And we know that people are use drugs everywhere and are dying everywhere. So this is a big, important thing. I looked through the thing and gave lots and lots of advice on what the report, the justification and motivation for this, for the report itself, because it's been such a really needed thing for so long. And when people are asking, well, why do we need this in Yale Town? It's like, well, we're finding too many bodies, actually, mm-hmm. is why you need it here. Your neighbors are dying. And there's other areas of the city that are that do as well, but this has been by that downtown south. I won't, not Yale Town, but downtown south wide generally has had by far the second highest number of calls for a very long time.
Yeah, you talked about the importance of establishing overdose prevention sites outside of the downtown east side. Can you kind of tell me, I guess, the importance of kind of establishing them outside of that area? Because the downtown east side is kind of known as quote unquote the center of the overdose crisis. But yeah. Kind of what's the importance of expanding them?
Well, there's a couple of different reasons, right? I mean, first of all, if someone is using drugs, there are many reasons, but I mean, at the core of it, people use drugs because drugs are just drugs. They're self-medicating in one way or another. And, whether you're using stimulants, whether you're using an opiate, you're doing something because you can't get it elsewhere. Basically, because you've been excluded in that sense from a medical system of getting the same substance or the same sort of class of substance, right? I mean, it mm-hmm. turns out if you ask people, most people who use stimulants only are undiagnosed ADHD or autistic. And that's why that's a big reason why, and you see the correlation, and it makes a lot of sense. So we need these sites, first of all, outside the downtown east side, so that people don't have to go into the downtown east side. If you're using, use as safely as possible. It's safer to use outside of the neighborhood if there's a site there. Because you don't want to get all the influence of yet more drugs, yet more, poverty, violence, the rest of it. We don't need to, we don't need to pull more people in to having to, get things as bad as they are in their own lives and in this place. It's really tough that the number of people who are dying down here has made this a very, very difficult place. and we don't need people to have to come down here to be safe. It's a contradiction. You know, and people are already using drugs in other parts of the city. If we're going to actually meet people where they're at, which is, the first idea of harm reduction, we don't need to have big, huge sites for everywhere. But we do actually need to have a room in every neighborhood where someone can go in and use safely 1 or 2 feet. And that's just know that they're observed and know that they're safe if they're still having to be compelled to use illicit drugs. And that's also the best and easiest place. If someone comes in and says, I'm using this stuff, I don't know what it is, I'm scared I might die, I'm going to use here, it's a great place to say, hey, would you like, I can help you find safe supply. Can I help you with that? Are you interested? That place is the best place to do that, isn't it? It's the most logical place. So we don't want people to have to be, it's the saying in the neighborhood, it's like you will save your life, but first you have to die. You know, it's kind of like the rock that hit rock bottom philosophy of social context. We don't need to get things this bad. And I don't want this to get this bad for everybody else in order to get for anything to get better. That's a terrible, terrible aim. So let's stop it as let's prevent things from getting that bad. People are saying, yes, all for weeks now, oh, it's going to turn this neighborhood into the downtown east side. And that's exactly what I want to prevent by having a sense here. Because, we don't, public drug use bothers you? Yeah, if public drug use bothers the people using, they have nowhere else to go. That's the whole point. I don't want children seeing people, using drugs either. Let's have the people use inside because they have nowhere else to go. And in the same way, you can't prevent a child from seeing homeless people if there are no homes. And you can't blame the people who are being victimized by our society because they're being victimized. And the fact is that, people right now, you see this all over the place. People are not angry, like the mainstream, middle class, whatever. They're not angry because people are homeless and are going to do something about homelessness. They're angry because they can see it. They're angry because the suffering is visible. And that's, I'm still trying to get my head around what that actually means, but that's really consistent. They're not interested in fighting against injustice or in solving social problems. They just want them to be out of sight. It's messed up. And I mean, in that regard, I can't help but think, I was thinking this all like yesterday. It's like, towards the people in Yale, I'm like, have you guys heard about the pandemic? Because things are really bad and they're going to get worse. And just getting things, they just seem, I just kept asking, where do you think the people are going to go if we don't have this? Where will they go? No one has an answer for that. No one's interested in actually solving a problem. They just don't want to see it.
Why do you think city staff chose this location at the corner of Seymour and Helpkin for the site? Because I know that there was a lot of talk about drug use around the Granville area. Is it kind of connected to that? Or
we were saying in the chat group, in the community action team, we were saying somewhere on or just near the Granville Strip, right? Mm-hmm. So people going out. And I mean, we don't have anything more specific. We didn't make any more specific recommendation. And it turned out that this is a city-owned building, for one thing, so the city, so they can do things with it. And the one that the ground floor tenant was leaving. I mean, as far as I can tell, not knowing the details of real estate, they seem to, I guess that's the reason why. It's also, the other reason why moving it from St. Paul's, the St. Paul's site is going to be going to move inside, but it's only going to be for patients, for people who are actually patients in the hospital, okay? Mm-hmm. And that means, so one of the biggest problems with the St. Paul's thing in the trailer was that it was a trailer and not fully accessible. This site on Seymour is fully accessible, and that's a big deal.
And how will this OPS site, let's say it gets approved and it comes into that intersection at Seymour and Helpkin, how will this OPS site improve the lives of people who use drugs in the area?
Well, there'll be less dead. I mean, mm-hmm. one thing, I mean, the second thing, I mean, you know, the big thing is, I found this when, you know, when I was working at back, in, you know, when we first had authorization to open overdose prevention sites, people would come in and they were just like, they were amazed. You know, these people have seen it all, a lot of them, but it's like, I could just sit here like a normal person and use inside and you'll help me if I have to. It's amazing. People start to, they didn't even tell me this. They start to feel human again. Like they're just having a normal conversation with somebody and they're just like, wow, you know, I'm not hiding behind a dumpster in the rain. No, come here, take your time, do your thing, whatever. Imagine never being able to do that, to go have, you could, no beer. You can't have a beer unless you really want one and you buy one off the street, off some guy, and then you go drink it, but don't let anyone see you. You know, like it's just that, it's so, prohibition is so absurd that it's done this, you've done this to each other. That's what's twisted. I mean, that's what really made people think about how messed up and how the drug war, actually the prohibition, how it's affected their lives, how it's diminished our existences. You can't even, you're blown away. You're shocked by the fact that you can just sit quietly at a table, take your drugs, whatever they may be, have a nice conversation, and put your coat on and leave. It's not that big a deal, but that's been what, like, that was amazing to people. And that makes you, that just, that changes everything. It changed, that in itself, it starts to build your self-esteem. You start to make friends, right? You start to feel like you're a part of something, like you give a shit about something. That's the beginning of everything again. And I've seen, and that's where I see people go and start saying, hey, I want to go, can you hook me up with such and such? And it's treatment or it's a doctor or it's this or housing or anything. Because they know that they, God damn it, they do deserve that. They are human. It's a wonder, and that's an amazing thing to see that change. And it doesn't have anything to do with drugs. It has to do with being human and being treated like one.
So yesterday's city council meeting, I mean, you were there, you were speaking, you were listening to it, and yeah, it got pretty heated, to say the least. Yeah. What were your thoughts on what went down?
Well, I mean, I've been dealing with this for several weeks now because, you know, just doing a lot of the media and stuff like that, and the lovely, you know, the stuff that I get back on Twitter and things like that, it's just, you know, it's a wide, wide array of people wishing me dead. Things like that, just you know, just great stuff. But I do bear in mind, actually, that this is a small and vocal minority. I think people get it. I think the neighbors get it. I think the wider residents of Vancouver get it. That, I mean, and this is not that complicated. You know, it's like, if you don't want crap on the street, make toilets, have some toilets. If you don't want public drug use, use indoors. If you don't want, you know, 150 people dying every month in the province, if you don't want 50 people dying in the city, much more than one a day, it's awful. If you don't want that to happen, you need to do everything we can. And this is actually the first step. Oh, safe supply. We can't connect anyone with safe supply until we start talking to each other. You know, and I think that people do get that. And I think that people really want this to end. This is going to indict us all. If people are going to look back at this time around in Canada and say, why didn't they just do what they needed to do? It was so obvious. Instead, they had to let thousands of people die for no reason. That's a terrible thing to have done. That's what they're going to say about us, because we just didn't have the bravery to do it.
You were saying earlier that this isn't that, like, this overdose prevention site, that this, I don't remember your exact words, but you were saying this isn't the first step and that there's more that needs to be done. What are the other steps?
Well, there's safe supply, first of all. If you can start getting people connected with prescribed or a bit like known substances. You know, right now people are using drugs that are really, who knows what. But when we start having people using what, like, known substances from a doctor, prescribed to a nurse, that sort of thing, that will actually keep them, that will actually not kill them. See, the thing with overdose prevention sites, they don't prevent overdoses, right? They prevent death. They're death prevention sites because people overdose all the time, but we bring them back. Safe supply prevents the overdose because you're just using drugs the same as you would any other drug that you get from a doctor. You're not going to overdose. It's not poison. So that's the next step. And after that, you see what it starts to do is what we start to do when we're getting our drugs from doctors is that they're not illegal anymore. So we start to decriminalize. And that's us decriminalizing ourselves, and that society in general realizing that, you know, that we're not criminals either. That step around decriminalization, what is parallel to that is we've got to do something about poverty, and that in turn is with people who are unhoused. The last government, the NDP, did not aggressively address core need poverty. They did not in any serious way. Is a major failure, and that will keep this going. I mean, that would be something that would be. I mean, that to me, that's the most obvious need. If they're hesitant because no one wants to talk about drugs, well then just address poverty. We don't need people to be this poor. Not in this place. This is ridiculous. You know, raise the rate. Raise the shelter rate. The shelter rate is $375 a month. Where are you going to rent anything like that? Nowhere. I mean, $375 a month where you can only that pays for your social housing. That's why social housing is falling apart, because that's simply not enough money. You've institutionalized an entire, like, everybody who was poor at the time. Like, this, no one needs to stay this poor. Now it's become a poverty that no one can get out of, and people who are in core need will never ever be dysfunctional ever, because people are getting on welfare $760 a month, $760 a month, and that includes their $375. That is punishment. We do not have to do that. We can look at the economy. We can say, look, no one needs to live like this. The stuff people steal is almost all survival. It's all survival stuff. We don't need this. We don't need to have a downtown east side. People can live with dignity. It's a choice. Poverty like this is a choice, absolutely. And if you have safe supply and we do something about poverty, people, we do not have to live this way. And it is a policy choice. Overdoses will end.
And kind of shifting things back to what happened at the city council meeting. There were a lot of people at that meeting who were like, you were there, you heard the kind of the concerns, like they were afraid of things like public safety. And, you know, there were some people saying like, my wife and children are afraid to walk home at night. There were concerns about crime. How would you kind of respond to those kind of concerns?
What I would say, I was writing up this thing at the time too. What I want to do and what, if this is approved, what I'm going to do is we're going to get like an outreach teams out there, and we're going to talk to the users. Hey, this is opening soon. Hey, will you blah 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 blah, and talk to people about what's going on with them and what, you know. And this is just what I do, and then try and see where are they at. Like, that's the first thing. Where are they at? Do you have a place? Where are you staying? What's going on? What's going on with you lately? How is it, you know, that sort of thing, and then try to solve these problems as they are. Nobody wants to be, you know, in this sort of situation. And of course, you know, when people are acting desperate as they are, and I'm seeing this down in the downtown east side too, when people are acting this desperate, it's usually because they haven't slept in several days and they haven't eaten in several days more. That messes up. That you get messed up and you get angry, like in a flash, and people are freaking out about their rose bushes, and you are, you know, and your friend just died, and you have, you know, and all kinds of horrible things are happening that are just unspeakable. And this is honestly what I'm going to be doing is trying to bring people in and start a dialogue first with users and then with some of the people. And we're going to settle things down. And this is what happens. What happens in, I mean, you've got lots of, like, good Lord, all around the world. When you start one of these sites, the situation around it, the what you call it, a public order, that sort of thing, it settles down because people have somewhere to go. I mean, that's been one of the biggest problems throughout the entire COVID situation, is that not only people who are unhoused, but people who are accustomed to living outdoors, like people who hang out outside, people who live in very small places, people who are, you know, live in congregate settings. You have nowhere to go because everything's shut. And we have none of those options. What are you going to do, work from home? When your work is binning, that's not what you do. You work outside. How are you going to see your friends? You can't. How are you going to do anything? People selling drugs on the street is, in fact, a job, you know? And that's an employment option that you can't do any other way. And frankly, in the downtown east side, the drug retailers, I spoke with them back in the spring about what was happening, what COVID was about. And they were the first to wear masks and have hand sanitizer. And they were modeling that for everybody else because they have the most contact. And why didn't we have a big outbreak in the downtown east side? Because the drug dealers were responsible. And there's all kinds of different ways that an illicit economy works. But that's one of them for sure. All these kinds of employment, like everything economically, is just a mess down here, because everyone gets these little gig jobs here and there. Somebody pays you $20 just to clean the windows of your store. Somebody pays you this to do that. All of that is gone. Nobody's making any extra cash anywhere. So everybody's extra poor. Everybody is getting that like an extra a bump, but everything is so uncertain. People are freaked out about it. And because of guest restrictions, because of social distancing in all the single unit buildings, no guests were allowed for months and months and months. So why did so many people die from overdoses? Because they would usually have their friends over to make sure that you weren't using alone, right? If you tell everybody you can't, don't use alone. And then the housing operators are like, no guests, you know, so you can't do it. You can't do both. And of course, the other thing is a lot more people are unhoused because so many people were crashing with friends or partners or cousins or what have you. They were all staying as buddies, and then they all got kicked out. So there's a lot more people who have nowhere to go than ever before. And we've got to figure something out with that. And we've got to start recognizing that people don't, it's not that people don't follow the rules, it's that the rules don't work for the situation that we're in. And I don't mean COVID, I mean very, very broadly, because this is a mess. And frankly, Josh, it's since 2016, since the declaration of an overdose emergency was declared, almost 1,000 people have died in the neighborhood. Almost 1,000 people in this confines of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
This is a completely different place now. We've all lost a lot of friends. We've all lost our social connections because I know that guy who knows that guy. Oh, that guy died, so now I don't know that guy. You know, it's like all that sort of thing. Those connections are what held us together, and they're all gone. So, and people don't seem to realize that because they just don't even see us as having, you know, as being, obviously, from what we saw yesterday, they don't even see us being human, which is just frankly heartbreaking because you'd think they'd have figured that out by now.
Before I ask the next question, I just want to say, like, kind of thank you so much for just, like, being able to talk about this with me and all. I know it's just probably just terribly sad to talk about, and so I just kind of really appreciate you just being able to share all this.
Yeah.
And I actually only have one more question for you here. With the Yaletown site, how do you think council is eventually going to vote on this?
When I spoke yesterday, I had them. So I'm really mad that they just bailed, they could have extended for half an hour and they would have been voted. It would have been unanimous vote. Very confident we would have. I'm really annoyed about that. But I think we'll get them. I think we'll get them. I'm going to work my ass off in the next week to get them, to communicate, send letters and whatnot. This city needs more overdose prevention, death prevention. We need to do more, but we need to start with this. you know, we need one in the Southeast too. We need one out. I mean, I can't get any information out of UBC, frankly. I don't know if we need one out there, but I bet we do. And I worry about that sort of thing. But, you know, we don't need to, these don't need to be remarkable, controversial things. It's just two chairs in a room with a person making sure, keeping an eye on you. That's all. There's nothing high-tech about this. This is very simple. It's not a big deal. It's just that. And we need them, like, I don't want people to have to come down to the downtown east side. You know, that's like, really. It couldn't be simpler.
And that's all I got, actually. Is there kind of anything else you wanted to add before I head out?
No, that's good. Thank you, Joshua.
Thank you so much for all this. You gave a lot of great answers, and I'm actually.
You're listening to CITR 101.9.
Broadcasting from Vancouver in unceded Musqueam territory.
Have you heard about Megaphone Magazine?
It's an award-winning publication sold on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria by low-income and homeless vendors. When you buy Megaphone, you get entertaining and informative stories written by professional journalists, and you're also helping to empower people in poverty. Here's how it works. Vendors buy each magazine for 75 cents and sell them for $2, keeping the profits. With the money they earn, our vendors are able to buy healthy food, clothing, and other necessities, plus they forge valuable connections with their customers.
This year I earned enough income to take a trip to Victoria, meet lots of new people, and had an awesome time.
Don't miss out on this month's edition of Megaphone, chock full of voices and perspectives that you won't find anywhere else. Track down a vendor using our free Find a Vendor app, downloadable at megaphonemagazine.com.
Welcome back to On The Point on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard Karen Ward, drug policy advisor for the city of Vancouver, talking about the overdose prevention site on Yale Town. Now let's get to talking about the provincial election.
So on Saturday, a leaked video showing 9 BC Liberals, including Andrew Wilkinson, was shared on Twitter by Vancouver podcaster Mo Amir. In it, BC Liberal candidate for North Vancouver Seymour, Jane Thornthwaite, alleges that Bowen Ma, the NDP candidate for North Vancouver Lonsdale, uses her looks to get ahead.
The clip garnered much attention on social media, and in that interview we had with Vancouver Langara candidate, Green candidate Stephanie Hendy last Sunday, she shared some thoughts about the situation. Let's take a listen.
I saw it last night. I was pretty disturbed by it. It's really insulting for middle-aged, you know, older white woman to accuse a young Asian woman that she's using her assets to cajole the oldest MLA in the legislature. Like, that's disgusting. That's, you know, I mean, Bowen and Ralph had a fun relationship. She was the youngest, and she got the whole legislature to give him a standing ovation on his 85th birthday. And, you know, they got to know each other. And the fact that Jane had the audacity to say that Bowen was doing that deliberately to try to, like, block the success of Ralph or to get in his way, that's disgusting. That's gross. Like, there's no other... there's no other women that have worked with Ralph that have been accused of that. And so it's just, it's frustrating because it makes someone like Bowen not only have to be the focus of so much backdoor judgments, but it's also meaning that other women like her who want to run are going to feel like politics isn't a safe place in British Columbia, and it's not. Right? This woman, that group of 9 white people decided that, you know, that it wasn't a safe place, right? So, I mean, it's absolutely terrible.
That was Vancouver Langara Green candidate Stephanie Hendy's reaction to the video of Jane Thornthwaite making sexist comments about Bowen Ma, which resurfaced last week. Here's what Hendy had to say about Thornthwaite's apology.
I think she apologized because she got caught. I don't think that she you know, you don't have those kinds of assumptions brewing about somebody's intent unless you believe it. So I don't think that she understands how harmful that was, you know. And the fact that none of Jane's other colleagues bothered to call her out and say, hey, you know, that's inappropriate. Like, they just kind of went with it, which is pretty shitty, you know. Like, I hope that if I say something terrible that my friends are going to call me out for that, you know. Yeah. Like, it's I don't believe it. But I also don't, again, she's, you know, yes, she's female and she cracked the glass ceiling, but when you're white and you have money, you still have a lot of privilege, right? So that's a lot of, you know, it's the responsibility of people with privilege to pave the way for people who don't. And again, that's part of why I'm running, because I've always been a low to moderate socioeconomic status and a person with a disability. And I don't think that it's fair for the government to make decisions about income or housing when they haven't had that kind of insecurity before.
You just heard Stephanie Hendy's opinions about the whole Jane Thorthwaite and BC Liberal situation. And now this is where I cut in and share my rant that I prepared in advance, because otherwise the segment would just consist of me angrily swearing. Jane Thorthwaite is not special. She is just one example that garnered attention. And I don't really want to talk about internalized misogyny here, because I don't think that's the case here. She knew what she was doing. And while I'm not trying to play in the oppression Olympics, I think it's important to recognize that Bowen Ma's race factors in here. It was absolutely vile and distasteful of Thorthwaite to suggest that Ma was trying to seduce Sultan and playing into and perpetuating racist stereotypes about Asian women. This whole fiasco is proof that not all girls are equal and not all women are equal, and the neoliberal framework that individualizes these problems can only hinder progress. Thorthwaite is not an outlier. Something like this isn't going to be specific to the BC Liberals. When there are not women, when there are not POC in organizations, and especially in higher up positions, we cannot expect safe spaces. This white lady is not special. The men laughing along are not out of the ordinary. This is the norm and has been for so long. When you are of a quote unquote marginalized group, regardless of whether or not you truly identify with it, you will be constantly reminded of your place and station. It is constantly pointed out the ways in which your sheer existence upsets what is seen as the order of things. You can't even exist in peace. Objectification of women is so rampant in our society, and it starts so young and is so damaging. This is the reality. It's not just politics. It's in newsrooms. It's in universities and schools. And I don't have a solution, honestly. It feels hopeless sometimes, but a point to start on is amplifying the voices of those historically underrepresented. And I'm going to quote Melanie Thomas on this. In order to actually get candidates that represent what Canadians or British Columbians look like, parties have to be prepared to say no to candidates who are older white men, basically because they're the ones that will volunteer first, end quote.
Yeah, I mean, the whole situation with Bowen Ma, I mean, Isa really spoke about the various factors at play here. I mean, what really stood out to me was Andrew Wilkinson and Jane Thorthwaite even didn't even apologize for, you know, 2 days after. Their apologies were really half-baked at best. And Andrew Wilkinson later said that, you know, like when someone asked him, why didn't you say anything? He's like, oh, in the moment, I didn't feel like it. And that sort of speaks to the privilege in at play here, right? Because, I mean, any other situation, if Bowen Ma were in the room, they would not have had the audacity to say that. So, yeah, I mean, it just stinks. And that was something that was brought up a lot at the leaders' debate, which had its own share of, let's say, gaffes, to put it lightly.
Yeah, there was that really awkward moment where Horgan said, quote unquote, or I don't remember the exact quote, but he basically said, you know, growing up, he didn't see color, which was just kind of surprising to hear from him because, I mean, yeah, he's a white guy, but I would think that he would be more tuned into the discourse about kind of why that phrase is kind of a little ignorant and not exact and a little naive, too. So it was surprised to hear him make that flub of the moment. To his credit, he apologized right after it happened. But yeah, on the debate stage where everyone was watching and where, you know, all eyes are on you, yeah, he messed up.
I mean, he messed up. I think the quote was something along the lines of, because I think the question was about racism and how leaders were, because all the leaders in the provincial election, the major ones are all white. So I think the question from the moderator was about, you know, how they, what they would do to upend those institutions. And Horgan talked about growing up playing hockey with like indigenous kids and how he didn't see color, something along those lines. And
I think it was lacrosse, actually.
Oh, one of those, yes. And
yeah, he's a lacrosse player.
And it was not great. I mean, Wilkinson wasn't too much better. He talked about, like, because he was a doctor, he talked about delivering an indigenous baby, which was named after him. And that was some grand statement about anti-racism from him. I don't know.
And I remember when, right before he spoke, I was watching the debate with my parents, and right before he spoke, I said, I know it, he's going to mention that he worked as a doctor in Dease Lake, which is like way north in BC. And what happened? He mentioned that he worked as a doctor in Dease Lake in northern BC.
I think, yeah, Sonia Firstina was really the only one who sort of gave a good answer to that. She talked about how she can't really came to understand a racialized person's experience. So yeah, she really stood out to me at the debate. But yeah, the other two, like Horgan and Wilkinson, really did not. The past week has really just not been a good one for, you know, for white candidates speaking about people of color. It's just been pitfall after pitfall. And that's not, it's really not good. Really, really not good.
The bar, I just want to say the bar is like so low and still people manage to like hit it on their way out. Like, why?
That's a great way to phrase it.
Also worth noting that although Sonia Firstina gave a legitimately like very good answer to the question about like white privilege and stuff, her candidate slate is overwhelmingly white. And I mean, her defense is, you know, didn't have a lot of time to put together a diverse slate, but still it kind of says something when these are all the first people who are willing to do it on the spot.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, it's a problem, like whether it's the racism or like the sexism, it's a problem that's not going to be like easily solved. And honestly, it's just very deeply ingrained into our political structures and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. On the topic of, well, you know, the political scene being extremely bad, let's talk about Dolly Thrones. He's the Liberal candidate for Chilliwack, Kent. And earlier in the election, he got in hot water because he basically put out ads that supported conversion therapy for LGBTQ plus youth. And Andrew Wilkinson's response to this was, I have gay family members, which, not great, not great. But yeah, so yesterday, he got thrown out because he basically claimed that using contraceptives was similar to eugenics. So a BC Liberal is really the screening process. I think I could become a BC Liberal candidate at this point. It's not looking good from them. Not looking good. And they're not looking good in the polls either after all of this. So yeah, it's not been a great campaign for them, really.
Yeah, it was only a matter of time before Thronus got the boot. I didn't think it would happen this quickly, but I guess, you know, anything happens in an election and things change overnight very fast.
Yep.
Yeah, I was going to say, and I said this earlier when we were not recording, but I'm going to say it again because I think I have a point here. I think he might have just been kicked out because of like the whole Bowen Ma situation stuff where it's like, okay, let's do one quote unquote progressive thing to try and make up for that, because it like people have been complaining about like what's his name,
Thronus
for so long, and like they've only decided to kick him out now. Like it just feels like too much of a coincidence to me. Maybe this might just be like tinfoil hat eyes speaking, but
it does definitely feel like either they're trying to do something as like a show of goodwill, or to be a bit more cynical about it, they're trying to do something to get the headlines off of the Bowen Ma situation.
I mean, if this is the headline they're going with, which is we kicked out a homophobic MLA candidate, then not a good headline, really, if you think about it. I mean, I think Isa's point is very valid because when you're trying to get away, like, I think the BC Liberals thought that the Jane Thorntwaite comments would go away after a day, which is why they didn't immediately come out and apologize. But it's probably the thing that will be the story of this election, which started off with John Horgan calling it early, and that we thought that was going to be the story of it. But, you know, the Bowen Ma comments are really still being talked about, and that really has just put a match to the BC Liberals campaign in many ways.
Yeah, and we're still going to be talking about it next week with our interview with Melanie Thomas.
We are indeed. That's a great segue to the end part of the script. So, Isa, take us away.
So that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been On the Point by CITR News. We're here every Friday at 10 a.m. bringing you local news. And stay tuned for more amazing programming.